The Brendan O'Connor Show on RTE Radio 1 with All Care Pharmacy. Advice and expertise on the relief you need from hay fever at All Care Community Pharmacies across Ireland.
Our panel today are Ciara Phelan, who's political correspondent with the Irish Mirror, Gary Murphy, who's Professor of Politics at DCU School of Law and Government, and Ruth Coppinger, who's a secondary school teacher and, of course, a former socialist TD. And we are also joined on the line by Rona Mahoney, who is, of course, former master of the National Maternity Hospital at Holles Street, and I suppose one of the people who helped to broker this deal about the move of the National Maternity Hospital. Good morning, everyone.
Morning,
Brendan.
Rona Mahoney, can I ask you first? It would seem that your record on this on women's healthcare on this whole area is fairly impeccable, and also that of many of your colleagues, many of them female, many of whom would have been pro-choice advocates and everything. Mm. Why don't a lot of women trust your bona fides on this?
Yeah, I think that, you know, it's been quite difficult for women because over the last while a narrative has emerged, you know, that there will be a religious influence in this hospital, that women won't be able to have termination of pregnancy and other services. And that's caused huge concern and fear among women, which has been really difficult. Because, you know, I was there in the repeal campaign, and the reason that I advocated so strongly for repeal is because it provides the presence of termination of pregnancy services for women, provides better, safer healthcare, as well as recognizing women's autonomy. And that's so important to me. So for me, it's not a big step then to want all services for women to be greatly improved in the country, because for years, women's health was very much the Cinderella of health services, and we didn't invest in them in the way we should have. And that left us with a legacy of three standalone hospitals in Dublin, which aren't on campuses, which is against international standard, in building that really isn't dignified or appropriate for 21st century medicine.
And you see, we've heard all this, you know, trotted out is the wrong word, but we've heard it all aired and exercised for the last 2 weeks now and for a long time before that. What is the problem here with trust? Why I don't understand why you are not trusted, or I'd like to know why you feel you're not trusted.
I'm not sure if I'm not trusted, but I think it's much bigger than just me, Rona Mahoney.
Yeah.
When you look back on the history of this, Brendan, and you think of what's happened to women over the years, I mean, the history of women's healthcare in the Irish state going right back to 1922 is not a good history. It's full of pain, it's full of suffering, and it's full of stories of women who really were very badly treated and where real harm was done.
Mm.
We have to move forward now. And sometimes taking those steps isn't really easy, but we have to at some point learn from the past and start to look to the future and rewrite the narrative of women's care. And I think it's imperative that we now start to rewrite that narrative by improving healthcare services, by investing in women, and by providing women with a 21st century hospital that is on a campus that can give so much more service to women. We've heard a lot about services being restricted. What we haven't really heard enough about is all the services that are going to be added to our capability. So from ICU to high dependency services to interventional radiology to the cancer services, you know, 500 women with breast cancer are treated in Vincent's every year. The presence of a cystic fibrosis unit. Thanks to better care now, women with cystic fibrosis are actually reaching an age and having children and living so much longer, which is a fantastic testament to advances in health.
Okay.
The transplant units, renal dialysis, I could go on.
Okay.
But all of these services will now be directly available to women on the campus.
Okay. Ruth Coppinger, do you trust Rona Mahoney, her 51 colleagues and their bona fides on this?
It isn't about trusting the 51 colleagues and Rona Mahoney. I think this is the first maternity hospital that's been established since the repeal. It's the 10-year anniversary of Savita Halappanavar's death that's coming up. And I think we would have expected that at this point we would have a public and secular national maternity hospital. And we still don't, because the state doesn't own the land. It's going to be a tenant. And the St. Vincent Holdings and Hospital Group has got a Catholic ethos in the very recent past. And I think we can get into all of the lease and all of that. But what this
what
is exposed...
What do you worry is going to happen here?
Well, I think this is an order that ran Magdalen Laundries that hasn't paid redress to the state to this day, to its victims or to the state. And people are acting like, and I've heard you use the expression, phantom nuns and shadows. Well, phantoms can haunt, but also it's very real. The Catholic Church still has huge control over the education system, over the hospital system, and is actively an active agent in preventing sex education taking place on a comprehensive, you know, LGBT-friendly basis. We have a situation where despite us fighting for repeal for many years, one in 10 GPs are providing it, and only just over half the maternity hospitals. So these are real issues. The fact that the Catholic Church or Catholic ethos or conscientious objection still has such control over the services that women, you know, that trans people, that will need in the future. And I think what this whole episode has exposed...
If the land was handed over, would that be enough for you?
Well, I suppose the key question is this. Why wasn't the state and the government able to stand up to... If this is the only site that must be used, why wasn't the state able to stand up to this order, to this group, and say, we want and we need control of that land? And I think what's been exposed here is not, you know, that it's a few ideological people. Two-thirds of people are not happy about this deal. And I think it's actually exposed that the political and medical establishment as well was seriously out of touch.
You're taking one opinion poll last week. I'd also say that there was a march yesterday that was supported by the Women's Council, Amnesty, the Irish Council for Civil Liberties, People Before Profit, and the number of people, there was huge hype about it, and the number of people who turned out was in their hundreds.
Well, I would prefer to see a march that was built for and that was campaigned for, because I know that there have been thousands of emails going, and sometimes it isn't the case that it's always reflected on the streets, but I think when you talk to people, what this has actually shown is...
Can I go back to Dr. Manny for a minute? I suppose two questions there arise out of that, Rona. The specific question is, why doesn't the St. Vincent's Hospital Group hand over the land to the state if it would make people trust this situation more? And secondly, do you hear Ruth Coppinger's issues, the broader issues that are around this and the influence of the church that is a lot of people still feel is there in medicine and education?
Yeah, I think this is so important. There is no religious influence in St. Vincent's Hospital today. It is a secular organisation. The nuns stepped out of anything to do with healthcare in Vincent's in 2017, and with the completion of the share transfer, all association, if you like, with the hospital is finished. There is no religious ethos. And when you look at the
Constitution... Okay, hang on 1 second. Will you wait? Can I hold you there for 1 second, Rona? Do you believe that, Ruth?
The St. Vincent's Hospital Trust follows the ethos of Mary Aikenhead, ultimately. But I suppose the key thing is, why are we...
Do you believe Rona Manning?
Why are we even bargaining? Why are we having to negotiate, parse and analyse with this group about what procedures can and cannot be done? We should not be in this position. And both the consultants and the political parties who are spearheading this should have realised 5 years ago, when this was first raised and objections were raised, that this was a problem, particularly in a post-repeal landscape.
And what is the problem that we're bargaining about what will be done? Are we bargaining about what will be done?
Well, since Simon Harris up to Minister Donnelly, they've had to constantly go back and go back and go back. We're now told that these procedures will be available. By the way, not routine, not practiced.
Let me let Rona Manny back in on that, and then come to the rest of the panel in a second. So... Is there an issue here that these procedures will be available but not routine?
Absolutely not. These procedures will be absolutely available for women. There is absolutely no question about that. And we really have to move away from telling women, because it frightens people when they think these procedures will not be performed. I cannot be more clear. We would never have embarked on this move. I fought for repeal. I was right there early on in 2013 in the Oireachtas Committee arguing for repeal. I actually perform terminations of pregnancy today. I wouldn't countenance moving a hospital to a facility that would not provide these procedures for women, because that actually would run counter to the whole point of this move, which is to provide better, safer healthcare.
And so why, Ronan, do they have three directors on the board and an alternating chair as well? Like, why was that conceded?
The directors on the board reflect the strategic direction and the day-to-day oversight of the hospital, and represents the co-location. We're all working together with Vincent's. We want to work with Vincent's. There's a whole healthcare campus out there that we will be tapping into and that will be available to women. And actually, we want that healthcare to be available. Directors in any company have a fiduciary duty to make sure that they serve the women in the new National Maternity Hospital. They serve their best interests. And that's exactly what they will do. And I think, you know, we cannot accuse these people, when we don't even know who they are, of being somehow egregious or working against women's health. It's quite the opposite. And in this case, there are layers of protection in the new maternity hospital that have been built in to ensure that all services are available to women. And that is actually protected by the minister, who has a golden chair, who actually has the power to direct the directors of that company.
Can I just bring in some of the others, and we'll let you back in on it, Ruth. Okay, Rona, can I pause you there for a second? And Ciara Phelan, as a young woman, who do you believe here?
I'm not sure, to be honest, because we're being given two different sides of the argument, as Ruth has clearly set out there, where the fears are coming from, which has been echoed by many people, campaigners, opposition TDs, some government TDs, and Dr. Peter Boylan. But then on the other hand, you have government ministers who raised concerns at the cabinet meeting 2 weeks ago, have now said they're reassured about those concerns. You've over 50 clinicians saying that we support it. You're listening to what Dr. Rona Mahoney is saying there. It's hard not to believe her. And yet,
everything Ruth says is reasonable and reflects what a lot of people think as well.
And one cabinet minister that I was speaking to last night said that those in opposition are framing this as a women being asked to trust the state, and that no trust is required because everything is crystal clear and it's being provided for them in what they're asking. So it's
legally, it's all there.
But we have heard the arguments during the week about the use of the phrase clinically appropriate. And we've heard from government TDs such as Green Party TD Nessa Horgan during the Health Committee saying that during the repeal campaign, the Green Party slogan was "Trust her, trust women," and she said that that phrase essentially puts the power into the hands of the clinicians, and that it would be up to them to decide what procedure is carried out rather than what a woman actually wants.
And do you know, Ciara, is that there was talk of what people are calling a codicil, that either, I think Shane Higgins said he'd be happy for the phrase to be taken out, even though I understand then from Alice Murphy from the NMH that they were happy to get the phrase in there because they felt it gave them comfort in the right direction. So is that phrase going to be, is there going to be a codicil? Is the phrase going to be excised?
Well, across the papers this morning in front of the Sunday Independent and in the Sunday Times, they're saying that it is being worked on. But I was speaking to a second cabinet source last night that said they don't think so. So it's pretty much up in the air at the moment. I suppose they're hoping that, as one put it, that all will be sorted on Tuesday following the St Vincent's Healthcare Group appearing before the Health Committee. But from a personal perspective and covering this case over the last 2 weeks, I don't see why the government would not make that amendment or put in the codicil. And the Taoiseach on Friday at a doorstep in Kildare said that it insinuated that there was no need for it because he's adamant that, you know, everything will be applied for and what women are asking for. But it does seem like there will be further discussions on this, and there might be an 11th hour change on Tuesday.
And before I go to Gary Murphy, Rona, can I just ask you briefly, do you know anything about this codicil or about the clinically appropriate phrase being excised?
No, I mean, effectively, the word clinically appropriate does not, you know, bother doctors at all. It simply means that we will not be performing brain surgery or heart surgery on our patients. Right. And it also future-proofs because, you know, lots of new procedures will become available over the next 100 years. We don't know what they'll be
so
yet.
So your feeling is that it's similar to what Alice Murphy was saying, who is the legal representative for the NMH. Your feeling is that this is a good phrase to have in there, that this actually gives security that, all legal procedures will happen.
Absolutely. The spirit of this phrase is designed that all procedures that will emerge in the future will be available. But Brendan, before I go, I need to really come back to Ruth Coppinger. St. Vincent's Hospital is a secular organisation. There is no religious ethos. The values, the founder values, which are often expressed in constitutions, are not a code for religious ethos. All procedures that women require, including termination of pregnancy, tubal ligation, the provision of contraception, gender affirmation surgery, all of this will be performed in the new hospital. It's available on the campus today. There is no barrier because Vincent's is a secular organisation. And telling women otherwise actually frightens women. And
okay.
It could
Rona,
jeopardise
will you stay,
decision.
Stay
on
with
Tuesday,
us, will you?
The Cabinet have a really important decision to make whether to set back women's healthcare by two decades and abandon the patients and women of Holles Street or whether to enshrine the advances of the last two decades in a 21st century hospital on a leading Irish hospital campus that will bring so much more to women's healthcare.
Okay, will you stay with us? Gary Murphy, there are on both sides of this, there are people with honest convictions about it. They both believe they're right. Nobody has any reason to be lying on either side of it. But we find ourselves with two directly opposing ways forward here.
Yeah, two direct and contradictory narratives, Brendan.
Yeah.
I know some people on both sides and I respect them all. For what it's worth, I am the father of daughters and a granddaughter, so, you know, I'm very concerned about women's health. I tend to trust the doctors for the most part, I think. I take Ruth's points completely. I think it would be better if the state owned the land, but it doesn't. And getting out of that is very tricky. And if you look at what's happened with the Children's Hospital and building that, I mean, if this is going to be put on the long finger even further, I mean, the hospital might never get built, or it might get built long after we're all, you know, gone to our maker. So that would concern me, certainly. You know, I follow the repeal campaign very closely. I listen to people who know are on contradictory sides. At the same side, you know, I believe people like Mary Higgins, Rona Mahoney. I mean, the idea that there would be influenced by religiosity really makes no sense to me. I mean, the culture wars, there's a very good piece by Colin Murphy on that this is a kind of a culture war, but those culture wars are for the most part gone, I think. I take Ruth's point completely about concerns of religious sort of influence or shadows or emanations or whatever the case may be, but the idea that people like Professor Higgins, Professor Mahoney would be in some way influenced by religiosity really makes no sense in the current climate. And you just have to listen to Rona Mahoney today to say everything that is being done in Vincent's today or in Holles Street or in the Coombe Rotunda will be done in this hospital. And in that context, I would be satisfied it should go ahead. And I think this is why people get into politics. The Social Democrats could have went into government. Labour could have went into government. The Greens are in government, but they're split. But you've got to be in government to make decisions. And I wouldn't be a bit concerned if I was in government that this will have any long-term impact on my political fortunes. In fact, quite the opposite, probably. It'll make no difference.
You think in 10 years, if this hospital goes ahead, in 10 years when this opens, we will have forgotten completely this?
I mean, look at what happened to Fine Gael in 2016 in the February election. The same-sex marriage referendum, which they were in power when that happened, no impact. Look at what happened to Fine Gael in 2020 during Repeal the 8. I was out here in RT on a couple of programmes that day. It was great jubilation all across the state. Someone in Fine Gael said, this is a great day for us as well. And I said, dream on. And look what happened. It had no impact whatsoever. I mean, these culture wars, in my view, have very little impact politically when it comes to elections. And I would be convinced that would be the same here.
Okay. A text here says, maybe part of the problem is that in this context, the word appropriate seems to have a moralising, judgmental tone rather than a medical or legal tone. And this is because appropriate behaviour was a phrase we heard a lot from the church over the decades in relation to girls and women. Ruth, you wanted to come back in there. Can I ask you a question? It does seem a little bit like that on one side we have a lot of doctors and a fair amount of lawyers. On the other hand, we have maybe slightly fewer doctors and slightly fewer lawyers, right? And there's a kind of a factual legal medical argument going on. But that what it's up against is a feeling. And that a feeling, and if women have a feeling, it's actually strong enough to scupper all the factual arguments in the world. Is there a sense of that going on here?
Yeah, the women, the young people that will actually be using the hospital are paramount. While we respect doctors, there's a bit of a doctor's knows
best
thing going on
here. So we have to go with people's feeling over.
It's not about feelings. You see, there's an element of what happened in Repeal, this kind of tone policing thing and quite sexist thing of, oh, these emotive women have this feeling.
That's
I'm not saying
remotely,
you're saying that.
That's not remotely what I'm saying, no.
Shane Higgins has a piece in the paper, for example, and he talks about how could people even question. You know, there's medical misogyny in Ireland as well. You know, there's a long history of that. And the idea that women can't question doctors, sorry, that day is quite gone. Now, I gave birth in Hollis Street myself. Apparently, if you listen, we've had these problems for a long number of years. Now there's this gun being put to everyone's head that we must go ahead with this project. And I do have to say, I don't know if you were picking a location for a maternity hospital, whether Dublin 4 would be your top, you know, slot.
Yeah, where would you like to see it?
Well, where people are actually giving birth, you know, out in the west of Dublin, where, you know, Talla, Blanchardstown. I'm just saying it's another point that came up with the Children's Hospital. But key thing I want to make is this minister's golden chair and trusting the people who are there right now. First of all, Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael have no record of fighting on women's rights. Yes, they came at the end of the repeal campaign because they saw a tide that they had to join. And there's a golden chair minister. We've half the Dáil doesn't believe in abortion rights. We've half the Dáil doesn't believe in, you
know,
progressive.
It's half,
well, it's well half. You know, if you look at those pictures of the Fianna Fáil TDs, do you remember those?
But it was years ago. The history of
their
the country's history has changed substantially. That was years ago.
Well, and there's a big issue now about a lot of things like trans, you know, gender affirmation, and those things aren't. But look at what's happening
those
in the
those things aren't what?
Those things aren't majority accepted in the Dáil.
Okay.
And if you look at what's happening.
But if they're enshrined in law and if they're enshrined in the constitution of this hospital, that all procedures in relation to all of that will happen, can we militate against the law changing in the future?
No, but if you look at what's happening even in the US right now, would any of us thought, you know, 4 years ago when we were campaigning for repeal, that we'd be looking at the US, the most advanced country in the world, where people are using right-wing people who have, you know, who've gotten power in states, who've packed the Supreme Court with judges, etc., are able to overturn.
So the law could change in the future.
Absolutely,
but how does this impact on this? We can't mitigate against that, can we, in any way? We still have to build a hospital and decide we'll do what's legal now and what's legal in the future. How would the...
Yeah.
How is that a worry for this hospital that society or the law or the government could change in the future?
Well, the procedures, first of all, aren't written into the constitution. That's been one of the issues that's come up. That it's
so
been
you'd
suggested
like to see
that
them
these
actually
things
written in.
Should be written in. Yeah. Well, obviously, Ronan we don't Manny, like to
if that would help with this trust issue, is it not easily done? Shane Higgins seemed to suggest it is. Would that help?
I think we really want to move away from a list of procedures because we're going to change and evolve according to what women need, what our patients need into the future. And I just want to come back again just to say, you know, people backing this are women too, women like me, Mary Higgins, the repeal clinicians, who fought so hard to have the Eighth Amendment removed so that we could legislate to provide termination of pregnancy. And I can't say it enough times. This hospital isn't about what doctors want. It's about what is the best care for women. The whole driver of this co-location is the care for women. We walk around Holles Street every day. We see women in 14-bed wards. We see women in tiny, undignified postnatal wards with 6 beds, not enough toilets, not having proper operating theatres, not having proper labour rooms. And we see a tiny hospital shoehorn that is standalone, that is totally against international practice.
So do we need to sort out Holles Street for the next 10 years? Do we need to sort out Holles Street for the next 10 years, Rona?
We want to invest in women's health. We want to elevate the whole standard of care for women in this country. We want to create a 21st century campus that can offer all manner of care to women, because that makes women safer, it makes their health care better, and we provide that in a magnificent building that is all about dignity and respect and choice for women.
Okay.
And that's
what
we
need to sort out
Holles
Street. Do we need to do a job on Holles Street for the next 10 years? Because 10 years is a long time for women to be having babies in conditions that we all seem to accept now are completely unsatisfactory.
But when I was, you know, my first week as master, I remember walking around the hospital with Ronan Gavin and looking at it. I had worked in it for years as a doctor. I had been a patient there. I've delivered 4 babies in Holles Street. I've been on both sides of this. And I remember walking around and looking at the conditions. And actually, when I looked at it through the eyes of someone with responsibility, I was horrified. And I knew then that we could do so much better. Why are we not trying to give women the very best of healthcare? And that's, you know, including termination of pregnancy, including tubal ligation, including contraception.
Okay.
But this campus offers...
Okay, I think in fairness, Rona, you've made that point and you've made it very well. Thank you very much, Dr. Rona Mani. So I think you're going to leave us now, Rona, and appreciate you coming on today. Good few people texting in asking the simple question, why don't they hand over the land? And we won't get back into all that, but everybody has arguments on either side of that. Gary, an emailer here, says that you said it's hard to believe in the current climate doctors would be influenced by religiosity. Key words in the current climate, says this person, the climate changes. And I think that's the point that you're making.
But the climate is changing in only one way, would be my view.
Okay, yeah, fair enough. And then another person points out, maybe the women of Ireland would be more convinced that St. Vincent's Hospital Group was a secular organisation if it didn't have a saint's name in its title. And definitely
but just on that point,
really
quickly,
yeah,
because
quickly,
I mean, when did Vincent's become a secular organisation? People would love to see that, and that's why the letters from the Vatican are being asked for. And I think people have just underestimated the chasm that's there between church and ordinary people now.
Fair enough, yeah. In fairness, I think we should say that the NMH have said very clearly that there were no conditions. That has been stated as a fact. There were no conditions placed by the Vatican on the divesting of the land. That has been said. So
but
I'm just saying that for fairness. No, we haven't seen it, but we'll take
we'll
that
take their word
on,
for it,
on
yeah.
trust. Gary, there's a poll in the Sunday Times today, and look, all the qualifications that we give with an opinion poll, but I mean, there is a definite trend here, and the trend hits a new high for Sinn Féin today in that poll.
Yeah, I mean, Sinn Féin are 36%, Fianna Fáil at 24%, which is up 1%, and with Fianna Gael at 19% is the highlight or lowlight perhaps for them, for me. If you look at what happened at the 2020 general election, Sinn Féin, Fianna Gael and Fianna Fáil were all, you know, in the early 20s. And what's happened since then is Sinn Féin have just powered ahead. They're at 36%. They've been no lower, I think, than 33, certainly in the last half dozen polls. And on that grounds, they're going to get, you know, close to 60 TDs, maybe more, in the general election. Now they have to cobble another 20 for a coalition. They're not going to get an overall majority. I think it's a fact. But Fianna Gael, if you look at the front of the Mail, which we just talked about, all this playing politics, if that's what's going on, is doing them no good whatsoever. I mean, I think the difficulty in one way is Fine Gael have been in power for nearly a dozen years now. And if you look at things in housing, if you look at health, education, if you look at your cost of living crisis, a lot of people think, I think it's time to give someone else a chance. And that's a narrative that will, I think, haunt this government for the next 2.5 years. But I think the 2.5 years is the point. This government is not going to collapse over the NMH or anything else, especially not on
these
numbers.
They're hanging in there, Ciara, are they?
Yeah, but you're right. It's the cost of living and particularly the housing crisis that the government need to sort out come the next general election if they don't want to see Sinn Féin's support increase or get, as you said, up to as many as 60 TDs in the next general election. So definitely, I think Fianna Fáil and Micheál Martin will be happy with that poll. And like you said, Fine Gael, a little bit disappointed. But Sinn Féin will be riding out the positivity wave for a long time, and given what everything that's going on, it doesn't look like their support is going to dip anytime soon.
Things do change as well. Ruth, where do you stand on it? I suppose the first question you'd ask is if there is going to be a Sinn Féin government next time around, is that going to be with other parties of the left, or is this seemingly right now unstoppable machine that is Sinn Féin, is that hoovering up votes from the rest of the left as well? Is it the only show in town on that side of things now, as well as taking from the mainstream parties?
It remains to be seen. It really does. I mean, obviously, the increase in the vote that Sinn Féin got in the last election was, you know, phenomenal, but it could go higher, as has been shown by even since the election. And it's precisely because of what has been said that, you know, Fianna Fáil, Fine Gael and the Greens are failing to deal with the issues that are really pressing down on people. I mean, there's a number of articles about housing in the papers
today.
Yeah,
you were looking at, speaking of Sinn Féin, Eoin Ó'Brien has a piece in the Mail on Sunday about the rents are rising fast.
Yeah, there's a couple of, like, there's a scheme that the government is now setting up for affordable housing, you know, for ordinary workers. And they're only planning on doing 7,500 over 5 years. That's nowhere near what's needed. And it means in Dublin City there'll be 423 a year. And then the other scheme is developers will be given, you know, this €145,000 to build an apartment.
It seems extraordinary that the cost of building an apartment could be €140,000
over
the price of an apartment given the market.
And we've constantly heard this thing about supply. I mean, when I was on the housing committee in the Dáil, it was the same thing, supply, supply, supply. But all of the supply is this build to rent. I was researching for a newsletter, and in the Dublin West area, everything that's being built is owned by vulture funds. You know,
what's the answer here?
Well, the answer is very obvious and very basic and very boring, it seems, which is to build public housing on public land.
And this government is putting in more money than any other government has, I think, building housing. Well, they keep saying it because
they're
I think it's true.
No, it's not really, though.
What do you mean?
Okay, first of all, it's not going into public housing. That's the problem. It's going into the pockets of landlords or, you know, developers. If you look at Fingal Council out my area, they didn't build one social house last year. Now, they did procure some, you know, which is buying them off a developer at top-notch rate. We have to go back to what was done in the 70s, really.
Yeah,
you know,
I suppose the other question is we don't have the builders to do it, do we?
Well, this is the other mad issue, you know, that there's builders who went away and then they stopped the apprenticeships. But we have to retrain people if that's the case, and even if we have to bring in labour. But who's building for the vulture funds? You know, there are builders, so they are there. It's just that they're not being... It's an ideological issue where Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael have taken a decision not to build public housing, and it's happened over 20 years.
Yeah, I think they've taken the decision to start building public housing again.
Dara Ryan says completely the opposite, that's what Fianna Fáil was built on politically. That's where it got its votes in the 1930s, and it's back there now. I mean, I think Fine Gael has had a different issue. I mean, I listened to Simon Coveney back in 2017 talking about rebuilding Ireland, that there'd be nobody homeless by the end of that year, and the numbers actually went up and have gone up significantly. I mean, I think there is a case to be made for a social housing or public housing agency. I mean, what's happened up to now isn't working, clearly, as Ruth points out, and I don't often agree with Ruth, but I agree on this particular case. And there needs to be a whole... I was heartened to hear Simon Harris talk about apprenticeships. I think apprenticeships are really important. I think also going to university is important. I don't think that's just not a false dichotomy.
Stop advertising,
there.
No. Yeah.
But it's an important point. I'm not saying people should go into apprenticeships and not go to university if you see the difference. I think that's an important point.
I was going to say to you, you picked out, there's an interesting piece in Sunday Independent by Niall Toner where he talks to various people involved in this. It would seem that the issue Ruth and Gary are pointing to, is to do, a lot of it is to do with history as well, isn't it? And it's to do with like stopping building public housing 30 years ago and starting to put people into rental then, according to some of the people talking here.
Yeah, that's what it highlights. And Marion Finnegan, she's an economist and managing director with Cherry Fitzgerald, and she made the point that does the state need to reform the tax treatment of small landlords to treat them as a business rather than as their second income? And then you've, you know, Dr. Rory O'Hearn, assistant professor in social policy at Maynooth, arguing that people are stuck because they can't afford to buy when the state is getting a social housing from the private sector. And in Niall's piece, he makes the point that, and this is on foot of the Daft.ie report that came out during the week that shows an increase of 12% on the prices being asked by landlords on new tenancies. And that once upon a time, it was the case where when you're in your mid-30s, you were moving back home with your mum and dad to save for a mortgage deposit, but it's actually gone to the case now, whereas you're moving back home because you can't afford to rent. Which is massive, and the
is that going on?
Oh, yeah. Absolutely! Oh, yeah, it's there's a. People will be familiar with Kieran Mulqueen. He has an Instagram page called Crazy House Prices, and he put up a questionnaire this week asking, you know, how does the Daft.ie report, in particular, it said that there's only 851 properties up for rent across the state, and it's the lowest it has ever been since 2006. And how is this impacting people? And he gave examples of people who were contacting him saying, I'm coming home from the UAE where they had been, but they can't find properties to rent. There's one gentleman saying, he was 32, he said that he's worked for a decade and he still can't afford to buy a house, and now he's moving back in with his parents because the rent is outrageous and he's struggling to save towards a mortgage deposit. And that's the reality.
I have an email here right from a listener. He put up he's given us a screen grab of it. He put up an ad on Daft recently, right, for a double bedroom, not en suite, in South Dublin, right? He got 2,000, it was viewed 2,311 times. He got 378 inquiries. That's 378 individual emails sent to me looking to rent this room. He said some of the requests were heartbreaking. People looking for months who need to vacate properties within days or weeks who were absolutely desperate. People from abroad, as you mentioned there, Ciara, who had jobs in Ireland starting imminently, couldn't find accommodation. Students trying to take up places in college and not able to get accommodation. Couples applying for the ad to live in a room without their own bathroom, offering more money above the advertised rent. He said, I honestly don't know how we're supposed to attract people to this city to live, work or study.
Before COVID, we had a room that was available for rent
in my
house. Yeah. And I like the influx of emails, and this is how desperate it was. One gentleman came after his day's work, and the room, it's forever like an attic converted into a room, it's a fine room, and he begged us to say could he take it and live in it with his two kids and his wife. It was an ensuite and an award was based in a double room. That's how bad the situation is.
There's my own niece is moving back. Going to move in with my brother, and he's going to move into the shed, children. Yeah, basically. I mean, that's how desperate things are. But the government just seems oblivious to these situations.
In fairness, no, they're not oblivious to it.
They're not oblivious to it, but they're not doing anything about it. And I'll tell you why. Yeah. I don't doubt for one second that Taoiseach, Micheál Martin, doesn't understand the severity of the situation and he has empathy. But the mantra that supply is the only answer to this crisis is not good enough. And the issue is that we've had budgets, we've had they don't want to call it a small budget to help against rising cost of living, but nothing has been done to help renters. The government will argue that the 2% rent cap is helping people, but it's not when the price of rent is already at too high of a cost. And that's the issue. And we're talking about the Sunday Times, you know, poll on increase in Sinn Féin, and I don't think that this current government really understand that they're screwed come the next general election if the young generation are not sorted out, if renters aren't looked after. I don't think they understand how angry people are.
You think they don't, no?
Yeah, no, I really don't.
And you're rubbing shoulders with them all the time.
I mean,
I want to be fair to everyone. It would seem that a lot of them are decent people
who are
aware of this problem and who are really doing everything they can. Like,
but they have...
They're
just looking one way forward, and that's supply. And that is one answer that, you know, supply is how we get people into new housing and drive down rental costs.
And it takes time.
But they need to do something in between now
literally
to help.
Give money to renters.
They need to do something. I don't know I'm not a policymaker, not a legislator, but as a renter and from hearing from friends and reading the stories every day that people contact me with stories for the Mirror, they are just in desperate, dire need and they don't feel like they're being listened to. And that's exactly what the government needs to do here, is to help them some way. I know Sinn Féin talk about a tax rebate. I don't know if that's the right answer, but they need to do something.
The point I was making, Brendan, is the solutions are a bit piecemeal. A little bit here, a little bit there. Mm. Whereas what's needed really is some sort of radical surgery and radical action, whether that's a public housing agency or you know, massive rent relief.
We
could have one all-encompassing agency, perhaps, would be a way. Now, there are dangers, of course, in massive state building.
A czar, maybe? Is it time for a czar?
It could well be, because the result will be, I think, as Ciara points out, some sort of political retribution when the next general election is called. Now, there are dangers, of course, here. You could end up with a scenario which happened with the massive building in the 1960s, of ghettoisation, and nobody wants that, but that is a lesson from history that people would, you know, in policy making would want to draw on. So people have to be careful, but the piecemeal solutions that are being offered and have been offered since the last decade, they're not working, because as Ciara eloquently points out, my own children have no intentions of leaving home ever. Seems to me they're in early 20s and late teens, and none of their friends do anything but live at home and simply have no money to ever think of leaving home. And that'll be a big issue, I think, for traditional Fine Gael, Fianna Fáil voters. You know, if their children can't get on the property ladder, can't rent appropriate, adequate housing, you know, why not look somewhere else? And I think that's the narrative that is inevitably going to come stronger and stronger over the next couple of years, unless something radical happens.
And if Ciara's thoughts on this are replicated across that they do not feel listened to and they don't think that the government is hearing them yet, that's problematic. Listen, before we go to a break, I just wanted to say that we've been contacted by the Religious Sisters of Charity, who say that the Religious Sisters of Charity SC has met all its financial commitments under the various redress schemes. There are no payments outstanding. So look, happy to clarify that. Texter says there's a shortage of 50,000 people needed to build houses. No one can solve that problem quickly. That's from Mike. And look, that's a fair point. Now, we're going to go now, if you put on your headphones, guys, and we're going to go to John O'Brien, who's the John Monet Professor of European Integration at Maynooth University. And John, I know that a big part of your job as a Professor of European Integration is watching the Eurovision.
Yes, Brendan.
Yes. You had a party last night, I believe.
I had a party, and it was the first time since COVID, and it was only marvellous. I think it was just one of the most incredibly life-affirming Eurovisions in history.
Really?
Because I think, the story coming out of it, well, there's the usual kind of sublime to the ridiculous, but the story of the massive public support around Europe for Ukraine is the real takeaway from it. And it was really interesting to see that the jury vote was very different to the public vote. In the public vote, Ukraine got 439 points out of a maximum possible of 480. It only came fourth in the jury vote. So I think we could see that people across Europe really wanted to express in the strongest possible terms their support for Ukraine after the extraordinary violence that country has suffered since the Russian invasion on the 24th of February.
And John, what do you read into the fact that, lean into the phone there a little bit if you can, what do you read into the fact that the UK would have won it if it wasn't for the kind of curveball of Ukraine?
Yeah, I mean, it was a very, very strong performance, but that's because for the first time in a quarter century, the UK sent a very, very strong song in Sam Ryder's song. I really don't believe that there are any significant voting patterns that matter anymore, Brendan. And, you know, some people were speculating in the run-up to the context that Sam Ryder wouldn't do so well because there was a Brexit effect
across
the continent. But no, there is no evidence for that at all. It's simply that if you send a good song to Eurovision, you're going to do very well. And that's exactly what happened last night with Sam Ryder's song.
OK, so the Eurovision voters are kind of, they're above petty politics. So, do any other observations with your keen eye for European integration on any geopolitical stuff we can take out of this year's Eurovision?
Well, I think there were all kinds of interesting things beyond the main story, which was Ukraine. There are still some sort of voting blocks in evidence, Romania and Moldova, for example, Greece and Cyprus. But actually, the voting system, since it was reformed and since we have the 50-50 split between the televote and the jury vote, has really broken down a lot of those barriers. I've spent a lot of my working life in Central and Eastern Europe, and there was a period 15 years ago or so where it seemed that the kind of axis of gravity, center of gravity of Eurovision was moving absolutely to the east, and Ukraine was part of that. But that has been reversed in recent years with wins for Portugal in 2017, for example, Italy last year. And I think there, what we can see, and this is of relevance to Ireland, is that countries like Italy are now taking the contest really, really seriously, and they're sending their best performers. Måneskin, who won last year, for example, they've become a huge act right around the world, and broke the United States after they won last year. So there is a tendency, I think, Brendan, for some people to sneer at Eurovision. But if you actually look at this, Sam Ryder is a huge star on TikTok and on other platforms. And many of the artists performing are hugely popular around Europe. So in a way, the geopolitics is important, but the music is also important, and we shouldn't underestimate that.
OK, John, that line isn't great, but thank you very much for that. I think that it's clear to everybody listening who needs to be in charge of picking Ireland's song for the Eurovision next year. We need a Jean Monnet Professor of European Integration on that panel for next year, because that's as good a read as I've heard on the Eurovision in a while. Thanks, John. Okay, he's gone. Kira, there was a story, but there's a story on the front of the Mirror that you wanted to mention about. This is this little odd story about the government jet.
Yeah, it's on the Splash on page 6 in the Mirror today. It features across other papers as well. It's by Ken Fox, and it says a red-faced Taoiseach was left stranded in Brussels after the crocked Air Corps plane due to fly him home broke down. So we know the Learjet hasn't been in use for some time. I believe it's so old that they can't actually get parts needed to fix it. But essentially, he was had to go fly to Brussels for last-minute discussions on Ukraine. And when he was coming back, he was stranded in Brussels because an Air Corps plane that was to bring him home, there was a technical fault. And then it resulted in him being stranded there and waiting for a small, I think it's a PC-12 plane that's normally used to ship cargo, one engine, really small, to bring him home. And there was tetchy emails between the Department of Taoiseach and the Department of Defence, basically saying that they failed to get their Taoiseach home, and questions arising.
Then again, in the light of what we were discussing earlier and what you were saying, it's probably kind of a good look for them that the jet is so old that they can't get parts. Like, it wouldn't be good for them to be flying around in a brand new Silver Surfer jet or whatever.
Yeah, maybe not in a brand new jet, but at the end of the day, he's the Taoiseach, he's the Prime Minister. You need to sort something out. You wouldn't see that happen about other, leaders across the world.
Okay. Listen, Ruth, we've 1 minute left. Have you been following Agatha Christie this week?
Oh, I've been glued to it, Brendan.
Have you?
I haven't, but I opened up the papers and it's everywhere. Look, there are some serious issues about this as well. Like, I know people are actually just using it as some sort of light entertainment. But it does reflect, like, a sexism, classism as well. This constant focus on women's appearance, what they're wearing, how they look in court. We've already had the previous issue of Amber Heard. And which is, I know, a different issue, but that was a very serious issue of domestic violence. And yet, memes, jokes, and so on. A good article in the Irish Times the other day, I think, about how, you know, Netflix, the fashion companies and so on are going to profiteer from it, but it does reinforce sexist attitudes.
Yeah, and you would wonder in a week or two when we all calm down, will everybody feel a bit grubby for the glee?
Well, there's great concern about the... there's great concern, isn't there, about the agent of Mrs. Vardy, who has apparently significant difficulties arising out of her involvement in the case.
We have to go to news now, but I will say that the best line of the week was that agent, her phone went into the North Sea.
Davy Jones.
The barrister referred to it as being in Davy Jones' locker, and Becky Vardy said, "Who's Davy Jones? I don't know him." All right, thank you very much, Ciara Phelan, Gary Murphy and Ruth Copp.